Hello and welcome to another episode of Brave UX. I'm Brendan Jarvis, Managing Founder of The Space In Between, the home of New Zealand's only specialist evaluative UX research practice and world-class UX lab, enabling brave teams across the globe to de-risk product design and equally brave leaders to shape and scale design culture. Here on Brave UX, though, it's my job to help you to put the pieces of the product puzzle together. I do that by unpacking the stories, learnings, and expert advice of world-class UX design and product management professionals. My guest today is Ruth Brown. Ruth is currently a senior design strategist at ANZ, Aotearoa New Zealand's largest bank. The bank is so large that it employs a fifth of all people who work in finance and holds roughly a third of the country's home loans on its books. Before joining ANZ, Ruth was general manager of design research at Xero, makers of beautiful online accounting software and arguably New Zealand's most successful product company, with nearly 3 million subscribers and revenues of over $600 million US. But it was the 8 years that Ruth invested at Trade Me, New Zealand's equivalent of eBay, where I first heard about her and her great work. At Trade Me, Ruth was the head of user experience and later the head of people research, where she led a talented team of UX professionals that helped the business to better understand and serve the millions of Kiwis that use its platform regularly. An accomplished and humble design leader and someone who has been a great and generous contributor to the New Zealand design community, it's my great pleasure to have Ruth here with me on Brave UX today. Ruth, nō mai, haere mai, welcome to the show.
You, Brendan, kia ora.
Ruth, I have done a bit of research, as I may have shared with you before we hit record. And
you're
in my research, yes, it's something that I like to do, funny that. I discovered that when you were a child, your great-grandfather, a man by the name of George Modishead, used to send you a check from England for £3 every Christmas. And in New Zealand, back in the day, when you were a child, that would have been a small fortune. What did you use to buy with the money that your great-grandfather sent you?
I used to buy maths books, maths exercise books. So my cousins and my brother and sister would be buying kind of Transformers or Horses for Barbies or whatever it might be. And yeah, I used to get those kind of maths workbooks, which I think were probably quite new at that point, and work my way through them, which was kind of a step up from when I was littler than that. I used to get my mum to kind of write me lists of pluses and minuses that I'd sort of do myself. So I got the printed version, which was a lot flasher.
Look, I hope you don't mind me saying, but that is both completely adorable and totally respectable, but it seems to me to be something that is somewhat unusual for a child to spend their money on, their hard-earned money, or in this case, the gift that your great-grandfather gave you. What do you put that down to inside yourself that you felt compelled to spend it on maths books?
I think I just lived in a very sort of, as a child and then even kind of right through to uni, I just lived in a very kind of scientific and mathematical world. And I know that kind of sounds weird, but sort of that discovery and that kind of getting the right answer, which is ironic because now I've spent most of my career getting there being no right answer. But yeah, kind of just sort of just that thought process and my son is very similar, and I kind of see it in my son. We were at Christmas a couple of years ago up in Mahia, and my son kind of grabbed the cereal box and turned it inside out to kind of have the back of it. And he was like, I've just thought of something that I've kind of got to work my way through. And his aunties and uncles were just like, oh my gosh, this is like, this is very strange. But yeah, I think kind of just the sort of that thinking through process and then kind of getting to an answer at the end was so satisfying for me.
So your son's obviously been able to see you exhibit that behavior and may have picked that up from you. Was this also something that ran in the family as far as your parents were concerned or the people that you were close to growing up?
My dad was terrible at maths and my mum was very good at maths, but probably like many women in her sort of generation, you know, was ducks of maths at school and then kind of went on to do a teaching degree and then had her babies kind of during that. And so then actually focused kind of most of her energy on raising us as kids, which kind of is, you know, I'm extremely thankful for, but also probably meant that I didn't see what she could do in those other realms.
Yeah, and that wouldn't have been something that was too dissimilar back in New Zealand during those times. It would have been, I suppose, a decision that many women would have made. Well, I was just going to say, so thinking about the generational shift, you know, in your generation coming into the workforce, and you think you studied engineering while you were at university, was there a change in New Zealand where it was more okay for women to participate fully in their careers?
Oh, great question. I remember the most common response I got when I said I was doing engineering was, apart from one of my friends was like, why would you want to drive trains? Was like, oh, well, they do say that girls can do anything, you know? So it was kind of very much sort of assumed that, it was kind of like, it felt like an exception rather than kind of just, it was worth commenting on that it was a girl doing engineering. And I think when I did engineering, there was either 13% of people or of graduates were women. So yeah, it was a small time. I don't think there's a shift, because I think that I probably spent the first decade or so of my career not even thinking about gender. And then I kind of went into a workplace that was relatively sexist, unintentionally, but was sexist, and that kind of had to get dealt with in the moment, which was kind of, I'll sort of say it was at Trade Me, and kind of when we first went into Trade Me, it was a bit kind of boys clubby. It was, and good people wanting to do the right thing, but that's the problem with unconscious bias, right, is it's unconscious. And there was kind of
What were some of the tells? Yeah, what did you notice? Because it was obviously it sounded like it was quite a stark sort of realization when you started there.
Yeah, it was. Just, and it's kind of interesting because you start to doubt yourself and you start to kind of think that, you know, if you're used to sort of just solving, you know, sort of like, okay, well, what can I do differently in this situation? And, you know, and so, yeah, that's a really good question. You just kind of felt it. You felt like who was on the in and who was on the out. And then there was a survey that went around every year, and every year there would be feedback saying that the culture was sexist. And it kind of got ignored until Trent, who you will know from Optimal Usability, started it at Trade Me. And we were at our end of year all company, you know, where people do presentations, you know, sort of lots of 2 hours of 15-minute presentations. And he got up, he was second to talk or something like that, and the agenda was still on the board. And he said, is anyone noticing anything wrong with this agenda? And I was like, no, like, I don't get what you're talking about. And he said, too many dicks on the dance floor. And he said, every person on this list is a male, and I know that there are unbelievable amounts of talented women in this organization. And so next all company, I want to see the talented woman in this organization up here talking. And it was a shift change in the organization where actually it couldn't be sort of, you know, it was actually someone probably on the in calling it out. And then they did really great stuff. So, you know, like the leadership at that time actually kind of got sort of shoulder tapped a few people, including myself, to actually just write kind of a letter or sort of just to answer these four questions about kind of what we see and how we see it and kind of what the, you know, sort of what the answers are to that. And I was kind of, I could get quite involved in that and sort of, you know, use my research skills to sort of do surveys to understand kind of what was driving that. And yeah, it was fantastic to see. It was actually really nice to see this kind of deliberate change. And, you know, it was a bunch of really nice, well-meaning people who would hate to think that that was kind of what was happening, but that was the sort of ultimate end result. And then it was kind of interesting going to Xero, because I realized how much internalized kind of sexism I had of, like, because at Xero, half the board are women, all of the kind of amazing C-suite are all women, and they're like powerhouses. And I kind of didn't quite realize how much I'd kind of thought, oh, well, maybe men do those jobs because they're actually better at them. So to see these women being amazing at kind of being given all of this responsibility and smashing it was actually kind of, yeah, it made me realize how much I'd kind of internalized some of those messages that I'd got. So yeah, it does. Yeah, I think that kind of representation matters. I saw myself, you know, like kind of even within the change within myself.
And what was that? What was that change that you saw?
I think it was just realizing the internalized bias that I held, and kind of, you know, sort of once you see that, you can't unsee it, right? And I think that's what happened in that Trade Me situation. And so then to kind of move on and have some distance from that, but also be able to kind of see that, oh, actually seeing all these really powerful women in powerful situations has changed how I perceive it, was like, oh, okay, well, that means that before that, you know, like I obviously had kind of different, you know, it was hitting me differently.
Don't let me put words in your mouth here, but I got the sense that what you were underlying, what you were saying was that you didn't, even after all that time at Trade Me and the change that you saw happen there, that you still didn't feel like you had permission to occupy that space.
Yeah, probably. And yeah, I think you're right.
You know, you mentioned Trent and how he kind of called it out a few years back at Trade Me, and that was a catalyst for the sort of change and the realization that, well, we might have a, you know, gender diverse workforce, we aren't being very inclusive and not all voices are being heard, in particular women's voices in this instance. Do you need people like Trent still in organizations to call this out, or have you observed through your conversations with other people, your peers and your experiences in organizations since, that this is now starting to become part of just how we do business and that it's just the right thing to do and it's happening organically, or do we still need the Trents amongst us?
I think we do, but I think like we still have a way to go in gender, but I think it's probably other reasons to call it out, kind of, you know, sort of sexuality, gender, race. I think that those are the times, that those are the kind of places that there's probably a whole lot of microaggressions still happening and kind of still going, that yeah, need to be called out. So no, I think it's absolutely still needed. And I think kind of part of my journey when I kind of got to Trade Me and I kind of was like, oh, this, you know, like kind of like this feels really unfair, was actually kind of a kind of journey for myself to check kind of, okay, I may not have this privilege, but I have a whole lot of other privileges, and kind of what am I doing? What's my version of the Trent kind of call out that I'm doing for other people? Because unfortunately, I think that it still does somehow get listened to more. And, you know, we ask a lot of people's energies in those kind of minority groups to have to call it out, to have to be the person who kind of rocks the boat. And so, yeah, I think kind of the more that it can be other people in an organization who hold that privilege, then, you know, that's only got to be really, you know, kind of got to be better. So, yeah, job's still not done.
Yeah, I get the sense that unfortunately it's going to need to be a work in progress. And what you were saying there about you recognize your privilege, and while it might not have been the same as some of the, I'll just say it, I suppose it would be the senior white males around you, you had more than some other people. And I was talking with Lisa Marie Marquis, I think last week on the podcast, and she said something that I'd never really thought about. And she's a white American woman. She, to my way of looking at her, has been very brave around calling out this sort of behavior and sort of driving for better amongst our community. But she said something to me that, like I said, I hadn't thought about, which was that from her position, she was relatively safe, yet we seem to have this expectation that the people that are in comparatively unsafe positions, whether they be a minority gender or a minority ethnicity, we kind of look to them to sort of tell us what to do. And that's something that I actually posed to Saatchi Tolale on the podcast a few weeks back as well. And I felt quite uncomfortable asking that question. And that wasn't a problem for me, but it felt like it wasn't the right question for me to be asking. So I suppose in a roundabout way, what I'm getting to here is a question, which is, given what you've seen and what you believe, what is the best way for the majority, or whoever that may be, but the majority that has most of the privilege to to behave, to do? What is the best thing? Like, what should they be thinking and doing?
I guess I would point to doing. So I feel uncomfortable asking this because there's so many good people in those minorities who are kind of telling people and kind of, I guess my thing is to shut up and listen for a long, long time, do lots of my own reading. Cause I think kind of what I've learned is that sort of is you can stomp into a ground, but if you haven't done your own kind of internal work, then a woman I follow has a good kind of analogy that if you've got a cup of coffee and you get bumped, coffee is going to spill out. If you have a cup of tea and you get bumped, tea will spill out. So if ever you get bumped, whatever's inside you will spill out kind of, you know, accidentally or not. And so, yeah, I think it's kind of doing your own work and listening to a whole lot of people. So, you know, like I try not to have any reckons if I'm around anyone who holds that kind of, you know, holds sort of those minorities or kind of understands the lived experience of those. And so the only talking I will do is to other kind of, you know, or the only time I will have opinions or reckons is around kind of other, you know, other white people. Because, yeah, I feel like it is too, like, and I think the other thing to realize is that, and I know for lots of people this might be kind of seem like an extreme thing to say, but for kind of the worlds I live in, I think it's like accepting that I still have racism in me and I will be doing my entire life work to get rid of that racism. And while if I do something that is racist or if something leaks out of me, I could spend my energy trying to convince someone that that wasn't a racist thing and I'm actually a really good person, or I could go, shit, that happened. How do I make it one? How do I make it right? And how do I learn from it so that I kind of change? And, you know, like my husband and my son really struggle when I say that I'm racist and I have racism inside me, because they don't like to think that they're racist. But I think it's, for me, it's been the easiest way to keep learning is to go, we've all been swimming in this water, you know, there's no getting away from the water we've been swimming in. And to think that, oh no, I'm actually the person in the world that wouldn't have affected is kind of, you know, is very wrong, very sort of, you know, egotistical.
Well, it seems to me that part of the challenge is in challenging yourself to realize the water that you've been swimming in. And you gave a talk at UX New Zealand in 2020 called Bipartisan UX, A Call for the Middle Ground, where you addressed the ease of which we become polarized. And it was in the context, actually what triggered this talk for you was in the context outside of UX and design. And it was, I believe, a behavior you were seeing exhibited in your brother-in-law and your sister-in-law. What was it that you were seeing in them and the waters that they were swimming in?
Yeah, and I hope that story came out as in what I wanted to tell in that story, and I hope it did, was not actually the water they were swimming in, but the water that I was swimming in that I didn't realize I was swimming in until I went and swam in their water, if you know what I mean. So I think, so they are farmers and they in New Zealand at the moment, kind of with the Labour government, there's a lot of changes happening in farming and a lot of kind of policy, and a lot of that feels unfair. It feels unworkable for farmers. And, you know, farming can kind of be isolating anyway. And then, you know, kind of quite naturally, they were on Facebook groups about kind of, you know, about farmers and kind of those struggles. And it was starting to kind of feel overwhelming and sort of feeling like the whole world was against them. And I sort of say in the talk, I'm in groups where, you know, we're talking about kind of is veganism an essential part of intersectional feminism? And so, you know, like I kind of, you know, like I don't understand that experience. And so part
well,
of my...
Well, like we were just talking about before, like also you're in groups which are really conscious of the bias that they hold in terms of race and gender and other things and are willing to explore that. But there are many people around the world and in New Zealand that for them, their echo chamber is that's so foreign and scary, I would imagine, for them to even consider that they might have something wrong in the way in which they view the world.
And I think, you know, probably I think people probably have parts of their world where they're open-minded and parts where they're closed-minded. And it's probably, you know, the difficulty with that group polarization is exposure. You know, like if you just don't get that exposure, then you continue down those paths of kind of just having it reaffirmed kind of what you, well, to be honest, what we know about those algorithms is that you don't just get it reaffirmed, you get it reaffirmed plus kind of fries with that, and let's go deeper into those kind of into what you were thinking. So yeah, it's actually probably worse than, you know, kind of if in a village you've got a whole lot of people with different opinions and kind of, you know, you hang out at the pub with people with similar views, but you overhear the kind of conversations that are happening in other parts of the pub, or you're kind of interacting with them, where sort of the online and the kind of social media analogy is that you actually don't cross paths with those people, apart from to kind of parachute into each other's worlds and yell a bit and then kind of parachute back out into your safe space. Yeah.
Yeah. I understand that you ended up pulling some sentiment data for your brother and sister-in-law to try and make them feel a little bit better about the actual reality or their experience of reality through what was actually going on and how New Zealanders felt about farmers and in particular sheep and beef. And it was five times more New Zealanders felt positively about them than negatively, but it didn't seem to make a difference to them. Why wasn't data enough in this instance?
I think that as humans, we all think that we make rational decisions, but we make emotional decisions and then we use rationality to post-justify those decisions. So yeah, like evidence seldom kind of by itself actually solves it. So me kind of quoting some, and I'm very numbers focused. So I'm like, but the numbers. And so, you know,
look
like
at these numbers.
Yeah, exactly. So a better conversation would have actually been to try and understand them and try and kind of, you know, which is what we do all of our life, is actually sit down with someone. You know, if you sit down with someone, you don't tell them what's right or wrong about their opinions. You just understand kind of where they're coming from and where they're listening to. So yeah, I think that's why it didn't work, was because I did it wrong.
And you touched on this earlier, that realization when you recognized that it wasn't working, it was something in yourself, like your own bias that you were holding, that was kind of driving the frustration that you were feeling about them not getting it. What was that bias that you recognized in yourself?
Well, I think I probably have a bias towards kind of us, the climate change, and, you know, sort of what we have to do in that way. I have a bias towards the government that's in place at the moment. Like, you know, like it's I live in a world where all of those things are, you know, and I probably live in a world, I grew up with farmers around me who were wealthy, and that probably also kind of goes into that. I think what's interesting is that actually, who's doing more for the climate, me or my brother-in-law farmer and my sister-in-law? And hands down, it's my sister-in-law. So there's this other kind of, you know, it's my brother and sister-in-law who are actually kind of planting around their rivers and thinking about all of this stuff because it's their land, right? You know, they actually really care about that land for their kids and their kids and their kids. And so I think it's also easy for me to kind of have a slightly academic view on it rather than kind of the, you know, rather than the sort of, okay, what are you actually contributing? What's your boots on the ground actions to these things that you care about?
Yeah, there's also this, and you touched on this in your talk as well, this sort of notion of, I think you called it social comparison theory.
Social comparison theory, which, yeah.
Yeah, which is this need to be seen to be the perfect. And it seemed to me anyway that sort of leads towards quite binary thinking about right and wrong in certain situations like this, and farming and the environment.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I see myself slipping into this all the time, that actually if you're in a group and, you know, everyone is sort of trying to outdo themselves with how much they're doing X, whether that's kind of, you know, and any example in any direction, you're always sort of trying to outdo yourself, and to actually pull a middle ground almost makes you go, well, what are you going to the other side? Like, are you kind of, you know, like it's sort of, you know, and what we know about those algorithms and all of that is that actually that more extreme stuff gets upvoted. I think that most recent Facebook whistleblower stuff is kind of fascinating, that actually it's when Facebook changed their algorithm to give more family content and less advertising, the measure was in engagement. And I think she put it really well, that basically it's way easier to get people angry and engaged than it is happy and engaged. And so the algorithm was totally kind of pushing towards that, towards the anger engagement, which then, you know, just kind of makes, you know, makes kind of for a horrible place, you know, and not a very enjoyable place to be.
Yeah, and it's certainly good to see people calling that out, and hopefully we'll see some change as far as those algorithms go. And those algorithms have probably got some responsibility for something else that group polarization at the moment is really relevant to, and that's the I call it a debate. I don't really, personally, this is my own bias, I don't really feel like it should be a debate, but the conversation that's going on around vaccination at the moment with COVID-19. And I know this is happening all over the world, but in New Zealand in particular, it's been quite interesting to observe. It's quite a volatile social situation that I've seen. And there are a lot of people, and you sort of touched on this, Ruth, about people dropping in and yelling at each other and then, you know, parachuting out again at the moment, particularly on social platforms. But this is actually a conversation that comes with some really real public health risks. Like, people can literally live or die depending on the choices that we make as a society and as individuals within that society. What can we do, people listening to this podcast, to better understand people that are vaccine skeptic or hesitant? What are we able to do without, you know, getting into those yelling matches that clearly don't really lead to anyone changing their perspective on anything?
Yeah, and again, incredible experts in this area. So kind of this is my reckons. But I think Ministry of Health did a survey and ran at the end of August, which was kind of drilling down into how many are kind of hesitant, how many are kind of completely, you know, definitely would never do it, and what some of those reasons are, like what might change people's mind and kind of what those reasons are. And so I think I'm talking from a pro-vax point of view here. So if anyone anti-vax is listening to this, it will kind of sound completely biased because it is. But I think it's also identifying who you're talking to. So are they vaccine hesitant and unsure, or are they kind of very, very sort of anti-vax and actually, you know, like kind of how, because I don't think that we should spend very much time on that group, because I think all we've got to do for that group is actually love them, because, you know, they are feeling pretty average in our society at the moment. And so, and I think what we can sometimes do is we can group that entire group together and go, anyone who hasn't got the vaccine now is in that group of extremes that kind of jump into Facebook and sort of and blow things up. And I just don't think that that is true. Like, I think that this can't be taken in isolation either. Like, you know, it's actually, there is well-founded historical mistrust in kind of New Zealand and medicine, and there is still, you know, there is still racism in our medical system. So to kind of go, well, I toddled off and got my vaccine, so, and because I had the opportunity to, so anyone who isn't now, it's kind of their fault, I think, is, you know, is kind of not going to be helpful. But I think kind of sort of from what I understand, sort of, is it safe? The long-term effects, the side effects are kind of the key worries that people have. And yeah, and so I think it's kind of addressing those. But again, I think it's just actually listening and understanding where they are coming from and then supporting them to do that, you know, kind of supporting them to get there. And I hope that the more people see people around them who have had the vaccine and kind of it's fine. And I've got a good friend who is anti-vax, and I actually went out for dinner with her and our husbands on Saturday night, and I felt really sad for her. She's a very community-minded person. She's in that natural health kind of world. She's spent her life kind of volunteering at her kids' schools and doing things like that. She is extremely community-minded and kind of her community has said to her, you're in the wrong, you don't care about your community because you are making this decision. And, you know, it's almost like it's so deep to her belief that it would kind of seem weird for her to get, if she ever got the vaccine, that would feel kind of weirder. And so, yeah, I don't know where I'm going with that, but I think that, like I've kind of, you know, like sort of like I did in that talk about kind of like joining the Facebook, you know, like the farming Facebook group to kind of understanding what's going on. I haven't joined any Facebook groups, but I do jump out of my world and into those worlds and kind of to understand sort of what actually is, what's being talked about. And, you know, it is, I share science, you know, well, I don't actually share much on Facebook at all, but I quote science that I don't go and do the research of, you know, I don't go back and go, okay, well now actually let me look at this study or like, so I don't, you know, I don't kind of do the deep research when it comes to deciding to get the vaccine. I outsource, you know, flying a plane to the pilot. I outsource the decision on whether this is kind of good to me to the people who know what it is. But when you kind of drill into those Facebook worlds, they're getting scientific YouTube clips and they're getting kind of, so for them, they feel like they are building up evidence that feels like evidence to them. And so, yeah,
But coming back to what you were saying about the echo chambers that the social algorithms have created and how they effectively wall you off from each other, I get the sense that, and bias has been a key sort of topic in this talk that you gave as well. I get the sense that really they're just collecting evidence, in inverted commas, that confirms the bias that they already hold around mistrust around the vaccine.
Yeah, they do. As do I. As do you. You know, and I think that's kind of that's the hard thing is that those echo chambers do. They do it for everyone. They do it. You know, like my husband's really into kayaking, and he's like, if you use Facebook for your like non-controversial hobbies, it's great because he loves kayaking and they keep giving him kayaking videos and sometimes they give him the odd surfing video and he's like, yeah, I also like surfing. And so it's actually like the perfect algorithm if you like kayaking or you like knitting or, you know, you like something like that. It's actually just when it gets to kind of these difficult sort of contentious issues that it gets difficult. And I think that, yeah, I think kind of the hard thing about vaccines is that it does actually, you know, it does make a huge difference to our society, how many people get vaccinated. So yeah, it kind of, it's not like a, okay, well you can exist in this part of the world and it has no, it kind of has limited impact. It does actually kind of, you know, and that sort of that misinformation really, you know, it's kind of that misinformation getting to those vaccine unsure people rather than kind of that's the real high risk.
Mm, yeah, it has an impact on others.
Yeah, in the Ministry of Health thing as well, the survey, it had a section on have you seen misinformation on Facebook? And what was interesting was that I'm definitely getting the vaccine and I'm definitely not getting the vaccine were like, yeah, I've seen misinformation on Facebook. But the people in the middle were way less likely to say that, probably because they don't actually, you know, like misinformation, it's sort of, there is like misinformation as perceived by the person is in the eye of the beholder, right? You know, like, so the people who are definitely not getting the vaccine, they would have seen what is considered misinformation. And so, yeah, I think it's again on those extremes, you kind of see it, but it's the ones in the middle that can probably still be swayed. And I think that's sort of where we should be focusing.
Yeah. And you obviously tried data with your brother and sister-in-law and that didn't work so well. And then you changed tack and you didn't really go into what you did afterwards, which would be interesting to know later. But I really liked what you said here about listening. And as a researcher, that is one of the key skills that we have as UXers and researchers is listening and developing that skill. And my observation, and again, this is my reckons, not any sort of widely researched experience or data, but that what doesn't work is data with people that are skeptical. What has worked more effectively in the conversations that I've had is actually just listening and asking questions that aren't serving any other purpose than to help that person further explore the beliefs that they hold. Because if people aren't going to trust the data coming from the authorities that they already don't trust, they may be more likely to trust somebody that's their friend or their family member that they already have a degree of trust or love for or respect. And having those one-on-one conversations is really important.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of why people are pointing people to their family GPs as well, because it's sort of like, you've trusted me with all of your other kind of medical decisions and advice. And so, you know, sort of, I'm a good person to get advice from in this, you know, for this one as well.
Yeah, 100%. Now, it would be easy to suggest that it's just some of the outcomes from our work, like social networks, that lead to group polarization and the sort of dark echo chambers that are tearing, unfortunately, at some of the fabric of our society at the moment, particularly in Western democracies. I don't want to get too sort of dystopian on things here, but we don't have to look too hard to see it show up in our own organizations and design community, do we? You raised this, and I thought you were really brave. You raised this publicly, and it's not often that you get a design leader raising the mirror on the design community without, I suppose, some fear of repercussion. And I know that sounds a bit scary, but, you know, let's be honest, design Twitter can be a bit of a toxic place from time to time. How do we as designers sometimes get it wrong about what we feel about the people that are outside of design, whether that be inside our own organizations or just people that don't think like us? What are some of the ways in which that shows up?
Yeah, and I tell a story in that talk about, you know, I was kind of at a sort of offsite with lots of designers and UX people, and maybe it was maybe it needed to be a little bit cathartic, but there was lots of sort of complaining about the product owners and the decision makers and how they were kind of, you know, they were sort of like, you know, that they didn't care about the users and that, you know, they were sort of the only, you know, the researchers and designers were the only people that actually cared about the users. And yeah, I say in the talk, I said it was hypocritical, which was not a good thing to do because, you know, like that's actually doing exactly all of these things that I'm trying not to, which is sort of not actually listening.
Damn it.
Yeah, I know. There's, what's that, hoisted by my own petard or whatever that saying is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think.
You quoted a really interesting quote by Peter Levine, who I didn't know before, but he seems to be a psychotherapist or some form of therapist. And the quote that you gave, which I think sums up what you're saying here, is you can't be curious and defensive at the same time.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of in what all of those things we've talked about, right? Like at Trade Me, they couldn't be defensive about we don't have a sexism problem and be curious about what they might have. I can't be defensive about how there's no racism in me and be curious about how kind of what I might be doing might be affecting other people. And yeah, and it was the same with this. So, you know, it's, I think that kind of what I said at that time was that actually we might have these end users, but the people who are building the product are actually our users as well. And if we're asking the sort of product people or decision makers to really care about their users, but we're not caring about those people, then, you know, that was kind of where the hypocritical bit dropped out. But yeah, and I think that, yeah, and sort of in any group, it's really easy to sort of other another group and say that they don't understand. But I think that if you first go, okay, well, what am I doing and what am I bringing to this and seek to understand, then you're going to kind of, you know, get a hell of a lot further along than actually just sort of continuing to ram down kind of, you know, what you're thinking or your own perspective. So one of the things that we did at Xero was actually we all went and interviewed a product manager and actually asked them a whole lot of questions about what their life was like. And, you know, and it was so enlightening and kind of so, you know, helpful to actually sort of understand kind of what the world looked like from their point of view, and that they actually really did want to be user-centered, and that, you know, they often were having to make really big decisions without full information, which is a blooming hard thing to have to do. So if our report is going to be another 2 weeks later and then we say, oh, they ignored our report, it's probably because they had to make a decision in that kind of sprint that actually they, you know, they kind of needed that information straight away. And so, yeah, I think it was kind of just, yeah, I think what we ask of other people to be empathetic about their users, we have to kind of do do for ourselves as well.
Yeah, we have to embody it, and not just in one direction. And that was the research that Catherine Harper ran at Xero, right? She led that.
Yeah.
What, I mean, I don't know if you're involved in any of the direct conversations with the POs or the PMs, but what sort of feedback did you get back from them afterwards, after you'd actually run these sessions with them and sat down and talked to them?
Yeah, so the way just to say it, kind of, we ran research is a little bit, is sort of overstating it. So we did something called, well, it was called lockdown learning, which was once a fortnight, we did an hour and a half together on a different topic, and it was led internally. And so, you know, kind of all sorts of things we did, you know, stakeholder management or journey maps or kind of fast analysis or whatever those things are that, you know, you can get through quite a few if you're doing it once a fortnight. So it was just one of those. So we actually just went and asked, we interviewed every product manager, or no, we all interviewed a product manager. And so that was also cool because it was like some of them were people who we had really good relationships with, some of them were people who we didn't have any relationship with. And so I think kind of it's probably, I didn't actually explore that afterwards, but I imagine that if you have that type of conversation, it became a bit of a template that we actually used for other stakeholder conversations, because it did actually make those stakeholders kind of initially feel kind of really listened to, and, you know, we could kind of constantly go back to it. I think Toby Dallimore, who you've had on this before, I interviewed him, and one of my favourite quotes that he said was, being a product manager is like playing Texas Hold'em poker, you know, like you have to put your chips out before you've turned over all the cards. And I thought that was a very perfect kind of analogy for product management.
Yeah, and that, I mean, they're often out there on the limb, like you said, making decisions without full information. And anyone that's had to do that in a leadership capacity would know that that can be something that's quite uncomfortable. Mm. What can we do if we catch ourselves or we hear one of our UX or design colleagues bagging a stakeholder?
Yeah, so I think what we can do ourselves is kind of just try and deeply understand what's driving them, what their needs are. You know, kind of when we first went to Agile at TradeMe, we had a philosophy in our team. Well, we had two, actually. One was make other people the heroes, which is kind of in this because, you know, if you're doing research, you can often want to kind of be the person going, oh, look, here's what I found out, and it's really going to change this. But it's like, actually, if you just stay slightly in the background and give that information to the product owner or the designer to kind of have and to own, then they're becoming the person who is user-centered and kind of, you know, really, really sort of heroic in that. So, yeah, I think that's kind of one of them. And then the other thing we used to say lots at TradeMe is that we worked in the rhythm of the sprints. And so we really needed to understand what the teams needed and at what time. And, you know, it was easy at TradeMe as well because we could do guerrilla testing so easily because, you know, everyone on the street is pretty much a TradeMe user. So we could start with, okay, well, let's go out on Friday morning with what you've built in the last two sprints. By that Friday afternoon, we've actually deciding what direction we'll take in the next sprint because we've got the answers that we need. Yeah, a little bit trickier if you've kind of got a bit harder to access group. But the thing is still the same, is like, when do you need what by? And we might not do the perfect research to get you there, but we will get you what we need. And I think that's the other nice thing about working internally, is that I kind of use a bit of a sort of train station analogy, that if a train's already left the first station, no one's going to love it if you say, okay, pull the train back, we've got to go in a different direction. So what you can do is go, okay, train, you're already in this direction. What do you need to kind of keep the momentum? And then if you can get something else for when they come to the next train station and they can actually decide their direction, if you can at that point come with more information or better information, then they can make that decision there. And I think that's kind of really key, is to understand kind of where those decisions points will be, and almost never feel like I think in good product companies, you never have one shot at getting the right answers. And so actually iterating and doing just enough and building up that picture is a lot better than like, you know, no, sorry, train, you have to stay at the station while we get you all the answers because also the answers
are
never perfect.
And then everyone gets annoyed at you while you're busy trying to get everything perfect, right?
I think we can never get anything perfect in our world. It is just, you know, our job is to kind of de-risk projects. And, you know, if we do research at the start, down the track, we will kind of have iterated those findings. And, you know, like, so I think there's also sometimes a thing of like, our research is fact and it's not, it's really good clues. And so I think that's kind of it as well, as, you know, and that sort of probably comes to that polarization of like, well, I have to give the kind of strongest fact. And it's like, well, no, you don't actually, because it can only be as sure. It's sort of like the scientific process, you know, you can only be as sure as the information you have now. And the entire point is that it will change down the track when we have more information.
You mentioned when you're at TradeMe, you did a lot of guerrilla usability testing because the user was pretty much anyone and everyone in New Zealand. You could find someone that represented your user. How much of the work that you were doing there was in the more foundational or generative space?
Yeah, lots. Yeah. So we did a fantastic combination, and because there was a lot of trust at TradeMe, the leadership gave us a lot of trust. So, you know, like we did things
like... Was that trust always there? Sorry to interrupt, but was that that level of trust to permit the foundational work to go ahead, was that from the get-go or was that something that was earned over time?
I think there was probably a bit of suspicion. I remember doing kind of my first sort of user group persona project when I first got in, and there was a kind of like, okay, so you're going to travel around New Zealand to talk to users, and there probably was a kind of, okay, well, she's new and let's sort of, you know, let's give her this one. But, you know, so yeah, I kind of joked that I went to Levin, which I actually love. Like, my parents live in Levin and I really love Levin, but I'm like, if you go to Levin, you can't call it a junket. So that was kind of how I got around that. And so I think the other thing we did really early on was we always did the so what. So we never did those foundational pieces for like, oh, well, I have this question that I want to answer. It was always the so what for TradeMe. And so it always had to kind of have a reason or have a deliverable. But yeah, we were doing really cool projects. I remember doing one about how mobile phones have changed New Zealanders' lives and, you know, kind of, yeah, doing sort of really... TradeMe was cool because you got to go into quite a few of people's big life moments, you know, kind of buying or selling a house, buying or selling a car, getting a job. Like, they were all kind of like these quite big moments, and you got to sort of, yeah, really deeply understand the dynamics of all of those. So yeah, I stayed at TradeMe for 8 years, and I often joked that I was going to leave when I'd done a piece of research on every user group we had, and I kind of never got there because, you know, even early on we were doing like internet dating and kind of different mindsets for internet dating. And
was it find someone?
Yeah, it was find someone.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I didn't find anyone using find someone. Maybe that's why it doesn't exist anymore. I'm now happily married though.
Oh, nice. I think Tinder is why find someone doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, you're quite right. You're quite right. I just want to come back to the notion of trust with executive leadership that we touched on there, and also this topic of echo chambers and our design community, because there was something else in one of the talks that I had watched of yours that I thought was really interesting. And it's that you suggested as a design community, it's not just the polarization that we're at risk of between ourselves and people that might work in product or engineering or other aspects of the business that we work in, but we're often polarized in amongst ourselves, and in particular taking extreme positions when it comes to methods. And an example of which you gave in that talk was NPS, Net Promoter Score. You know, people tend to either love NPS or they tend to hate it. And you actually quoted a wonderful design leader here in New Zealand as well, who's a friend of yours, Perrin Rowland. And she said, is NPS perfect? No. Is NPS the only human metric in the boardroom? Yes. What were you trying to illustrate with that quote?
Yeah, I think I was trying to illustrate that when we live in those extremes, it's very hard to make progress because you're always sort of trying to just dig your toes in deeper rather than sort of, you know, back to that train analogy. It's like, okay, we're on this NPS train. How do we use it the best we can, or kind of, you know, how do we get what we can from it? And so, yeah, I think it's like, if we, and it also kind of destroys the nuance of like, oh, it didn't work. And, you know, like, it's sort of like a methodology may fail in one situation and then you use it again and it succeeds, or vice versa. And so if you're in those extremes of it is always a terrible idea or it's always going to work perfectly, then I think that we kind of we lose what we're good at in our sort of area, which is to kind of keep learning and keep going, oh, okay, cool. Well, now, you know, now we've tried it here and it didn't work for these reasons. So kind of how do we apply it differently? And so, and I do genuinely believe that we get sucked in by those same algorithms and those same kind of hits of like, you know, if people are angry about NPS or angry about personas or angry about kind of what agile or whatever it might be, it's going to get more reactions than if you're like, hey guys, you know, there's some good things about agile and there's some not so good things for UX, and let's try to work out how we make that kind of work the best. So yeah, I think you talked about design Twitter before, like it's probably exactly the same, you know, it's the extreme things that are getting kind of, you know, bubbled up.
You've been a design leader now for a decade or over, and you've held senior leadership positions both at Trade Me, which we've talked about, and also Xero as well, you know, two pretty serious product companies over here in New Zealand. How has your view on what's important as a design leader changed during that time?
As a design leader?
Yeah. Do you see anything like that you do differently if you had your time over?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Let me ponder that one for a while.
Yeah, sure.
I think that I probably didn't, when I first started, I was sort of like, I'm so sure on that the stuff we do is amazing and really valuable. And I probably didn't do enough kind of actually bringing other people on the journey, you know. And I think back to one of my first projects at Trade Me, which was kind of redesigning the homepage and the navigation, which, you know, if you know anything about Trade Me, that's a huge change for millions of people. And I think I probably in that situation thought, oh yeah, well, we'll just keep going and we'll kind of do our thing. I didn't bring enough kind of people or stakeholders around the organization on the journey. And I think that probably what I do now is I think more deliberately about kind of that culture change and what all those elements of the culture change need to be. So I think of my job as much about doing the research. So it's kind of like, you know, like get the good insights that people need to make the decisions they need to do to build good product, but actually kind of champion a user-centered culture so that like we aren't needed kind of in quite the same way, or that everyone is thinking in this way. And that's kind of a good, you know, that becomes usually half of my job, is actually thinking about where do I want this organization to be culturally from a user-centered point of view in 5 years time, and what am I doing in the next 6 months, a year, you know, what's our team doing and how are we implementing things to actually get there.
When you were saying that, I couldn't help but think of your train analogy, and what I was thinking was the train, the user-centered train, has left the station. But it sounded like you saw your job as to realize that it's okay to take stops every now and then down the line, rather than just never stop on that train and never be able to get other people on board.
Yeah, definitely. It's if you think about it more as a and I think this is probably, you know, you sort of, we talked at the start about kind of me being very kind of mathematical and probably quite sort of rational thinking. And I think kind of probably that's been my journey to sort of, you know, go from, okay, if I'm rationally doing all the steps, then I'm going to get the outcome, to actually, you know, there's a whole lot of people and personalities, and I think, you know, and those rational steps don't necessarily get you there. So how do we actually kind of, how do we think about the hearts and minds and the kind of, you know, other things rather than just sort of the steps or the processes that you need to do to get somewhere?
Have you ever had to pull the emergency brake on that train to get someone on board?
Hmm. No, I still don't think it's an emergency brake. I think I'll slow it down to a point that people are comfortable with, and I'll probably, you do some checking before you start that. So I guess sort of that's part of the learning is like, at Trade Me, I was like, oh, well, I have all the building blocks in place, and so therefore out the end will become a user-centered culture. And so yeah, but I think it's kind of like, okay, let's do a, sort of do a bit of a regroup and work out. Maybe a regroup is kind of pulling the emergency brake, but at every stop it's like, what direction are we going in next? And I think even, if I have empathy for senior leaders, like it's often like, so what would worry them about a user-centered culture? And okay, how can I allay those fears for them? And so again, it's kind of back to that curiosity and listening, and actually, understanding what their drivers are and how what we can do will support that, rather than kind of, sort of make them feel worried or detract from that.
Yeah, for them to feel confident in that culture that you're trying to establish. I
Yeah.
watched your CX Collective talk that happened not that long ago, I don't think. And I got the sense from that even though product companies talk a lot about the importance of their customers, that you felt that product companies still had quite a hard time being human-centered. Was that a fair reflection of how you felt at that time?
I think that, so it's been really interesting kind of thinking about the whistleblower stuff with Facebook, and thinking about, so my conversations at Trade Me, where we were talking about how do we make finding a house easier, or how do we make, selling a jug easier, were amazing conversations, because we all wanted the same thing out of that. The hardest conversations I had at Trade Me were about our ads and where ads should go on the platform and how ads should work. Because what you've got there, which is what I think I heard Frances Hogan, the Facebook whistleblower, talk about as well, is like, you can have all the good intentions and you can have all the kind of right, you can say the right things, but when it comes down to the decision of, we're gonna leave this much money on the table, which is measurable, for this kind of less measurable thing of the world's health, kind of the world's sort of mental health in a Facebook point of view, or, it might slightly degrade the experience of buying something, over time on Trade Me. Those are the hard decisions to make. And I think it was really interesting kind of going to zero, because again, like their whole goal was to make the product as good as possible for users so that more people used it. And so it's really easy because everyone is pointing in the same direction. So I think probably that has a bit less to do with being a product company and more to do with potentially whether you're in that kind of attention economy of, are you paying for people's attention, or are you paying to kind of get them to do the same thing? Because when you're both wanting them to, like if we make it easier to buy things on Trade Me, that is actually a win for everyone. If you make it easier to stay on Facebook forever, that's not a win for both groups. So yeah, I think that difficulty comes more when you're having to make that decision between, okay, money today or something that is less tangible that will kind of should be better for society or for our users.
Yeah, that navigating those trade-offs, that tension between the sounds like the underlying business or revenue model for the business and what's better for the user, but also I think you've touched on there like this the sort of stakeholders at large in the community and the world in the case of a platform with scale like that. There's a kind of popular catch cry in design, and it's been around for a long time. And it's one of the reasons why I believe I got involved in design, and why a number of probably most of the people I know who are in design are in it. And that's the sort of idea that as designers, we have the ability to make the world a better place. Do you hold that same belief? And if you do, or even if you don't, do you believe it's our responsibility in design as a broad field to ensure that that happens?
I'm a little bit so I think that designers absolutely have the ability to change the world, and that's kind of and that comes down to sort of where we're focusing our attention. And that's sort of part of it for me is kind of what you were talking about before, in terms of if we're fighting with each other, then that's not using kind of that precious energy. I think that, and this, you know, this probably sometimes bites me in the butt, but I hate the talk of like who deserves a seat at the table and kind of that sort of stuff, because I think that's actually then about us and our own egos. And I think a more interesting thing is how can we have the most influence in an organization to, you know, so I don't, you know, I don't, I put less sort of focus on the reputation of design or UX or research, and more on what's actually happening in that organization for our users and for the end result. And if that is going well and we're part of a really well-formed team, then awesome. But I think that if we want kind of to, just for the sake of it, and to feel good about our profession and kind of where we are, then that doesn't sort of hold any appeal to me. I think it's about kind of what we can do actually ends up in the real world, which is kind of part of, you know, for me, it's like, if we write a good report, who cares? You know, it's only if those insights from that report end up in a customer's hand that it's worth an organization paying for my time. So if I spend more focus on that side of it, then, you know, then that actually makes me feel like I'm kind of having impact.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're saying shift the focus as to what success actually is for design.
Yeah. And I think the world needs also the designers who are the opposite to that. So, you know, like, I think that it's like, you know, you don't need everyone going, we don't need a kind of presence, but, you know, like, so yeah, I think that any good ecosystem is made up of all of the people who are out the front, kind of people, you know, from behind. So yeah, it's not to say that the other way is wrong. It's just not kind of how I see the world.
Not really moving the field forward, that sort of combativeness with ourselves.
Yeah, definitely combativeness with ourselves. Like, you know, like I think intellectual debate is a good thing to have. But it does feel like a different thing to me than kind of piled on, or, you know, whatever they might be.
Ruth, a big part of our conversation today has been about echo chambers that we all inhabit, and also the social networks that have played a role in reinforcing some of the unhelpful beliefs that we may hold and approaches to conversations that we may take. What do you want people that are listening to this episode, to this conversation, to consider when they find themselves getting hot under the collar, you know, angry with someone that holds a different point of view from them?
Yeah, I think it's just step away. And, you know, what is it like? I think when lots of those social networks went down the other week, I think there was kind of like a collective breathe out, and that was sort of only for 6 hours or whatever it might be. So I guess kind of, yeah, just step away, just think, is this the best use of my energy? And I'm saying this like I do this all the time, like I don't, I'm as kind of guilty as anyone of kind of, you know, getting there and then having to sort of step back and realize. But yeah, and I think we learn as researchers, we're kind of always curious, and we know that, you know, like, if you're in a room of 8 smart people in a meeting, you know, you're not that, you don't have a kind of capital on kind of, you know, the good ideas or the right way to go here. And I think it's the same in those social networks as well, as like, you know, we're all a nature of, you know, we're all a result of kind of who we are and what we've been through. And so yeah, either stop and try and understand, or actually just step away and go play with your cat or something like that, something a bit more fulfilling.
Yeah, both are really good things to consider in those situations, but I really love this sort of notion of seeking to understand others better. I really think that's an important thing for people to think about, and a great place to leave the conversation today, which has been a great conversation, Ruth.
Yeah,
there are plenty of important things for people to think about. And I really want to say thank you for so generously sharing your stories and your insights with us today.
Pleasure. Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're most welcome. Ruth, if people want to find out more about you and your career and the great things that you're up to, what's the best way for them to do that?
I'm I'm pretty average at all of the socials. So probably LinkedIn is about as good as I get.
Wonderful. Thanks, Ruth. I'll make sure that I post a link to your profile in the show notes. And to everyone else that's tuned in, it's been great having you here as well. Everything that we've covered, including detailed chapters of our conversation, will be in the show notes on YouTube. If you've enjoyed the show and you want to hear more great conversations like this with world-class leaders in UX design and product management, don't forget to leave a review and also subscribe and tell someone else about the podcast if you feel that they get value out of these conversations. If you want to reach out to me, you can also find my LinkedIn profile in the show notes on YouTube. And also you could head over to thespaceinbetween.co.nz. That's thespaceinbetween.co.nz if you want to reach me that way. And until next time, keep being brave. Hey!